delicate man in a sad world. When a girl will break a board just because she can. Don't you tell me to deny it. I done wrong and I wanna suffer for my sins. I've come to you cause I need guidance to be true. And I just don't know where I can begin. Ooh, what I need is a good defense.
Damn, that's a banger. Am I right? How much do you love that song? I don't know if you guys saw the movie Hustlers a few years ago. It was in the before times, of course. But Jennifer Lopez, J-Lo, does a striptease to this song, which is Criminal by Fiona Apple. Classic tune. Such a good song. Anyways, let's get into it. Jen here. Welcome back to City and New Jimmy. It's been a hot minute, but we're back in the driver's seat for the spring season. Albeit it's not really spring yet, at least here in Ottawa. We're still at the end of April now, which used to be, you know, April showers bring May flowers, but it seems here in Ottawa we're getting, like, showers mixed with, like, occasional snow and, like, then it'll be really hot and then really cold. And anyway, we just have schizophrenic weather patterns. Climate change is horrifying. But anyway, today we've got a really cool guy on the pod, Evan Minsker. He lives in the States, in Wisconsin, in the Cheese State. but he is a former employee of Pitchfork, which I'm sure you've heard of. It used to be pretty much the top voice in music. It's what millennials, myself included, have been using for music news, going to for music news for years, more than a decade, actually. And Evan had worked there for over 10 years and was recently let go among a bunch of his colleagues, completely arbitrarily, by none other than Anna Wintour. yes, that's the woman that they make fun of, allegedly, in The Devil Wears Prada, the dreaded Anna Wintour, British journalist and editor. And anyhow, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Evan was very generous with his trauma and his story. If you've ever been fired, I know I have. It's pretty friggin' traumatic. It's not a fun experience. So really grateful to Evan for reliving that craziness with us. Wasn't easy for him. But I think it's important that we hear the whole story of exactly what happened, because there's a lot of mixed messages about what didn't happen. Was it arbitrary? Was Anna Wintour actually wearing dark sunglasses? Did it really happen over a Zoom call? We try to get into these questions and answer some of them for you. So stick around. We hope you'll enjoy it. And welcome back to City and New Jimmy, spring 2024.
Yeah. We'll get into this, but I am not currently bawling in any currency sense at all. So,
are any of us? I mean, Christ. well, then let's cut to the chase, I guess, or cut the cheese, as you might say down there in the cheese state. Are you in the cheese state? Isn't that the cheese state?
I am. Yeah, they're being a cheese down here. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I'm lactose intolerant, so I might, like, if I went there, I'd probably just die immediately, but,
Yeah, I'm vegan, so, like, it's wasted on me, so it's, yeah. Wisconsin vegan is, like, you know, it's a hell of a vibe.
You're a foreigner in a foreign land. Well, you're not originally from there, right? You were telling me you're from West Virginia?
Yeah, I grew up in West Virginia. I went to college in Chicago. Lived in Michigan for 10 years after that.
Where'd you study in Chicago?
I studied at a school called Columbia College Chicago, which is like a, you know, open admissions art school type deal. But they had a pretty good journalism program. And
cool.
I went there because I saw that, you know, they really encouraged internships. And at the time, Pitchfork's editorial offices were in Chicago. And I wanted to intern there bad, because that was like the job that I wanted to have in the future.
No doubt. That's the job every journalist wanted to
have. Yeah. And I managed to be one of the lucky ones. I got an internship in my last year of college at Pitchfork. Wow. And yeah, eventually from there, I mean, we can just get right into it. I got hired on a part-time basis to be their first nights and weekends news person.
Wow.
And that was in 2012. And then I basically was just there steadily doing a version of that job with like more seniority and like a better title or whatever for a dozen years until January.
Wow. Until January of this year, 2024. Yes. Let's bring us up to the present tense then for our listeners who may be unfamiliar and may not be like annoying diehard music nerds like you and I. Pitchfork, why don't you tell our listeners what was Pitchfork? Pitchfork until January?
Well, Pitchfork is still alive in some capacity, but Pitchfork is the, you know, quote unquote most trusted voice in news, in music, right? Not most trusted voice in news, it's the most trusted voice in music. I was just the news director of that website. But it's a music publication, kind of famous for its album reviews. You know, it had incredible features. I kind of made sure that the news section was indeed just like one of the great news sections in all of music journalism. But yeah, like the famous thing is Best New Music, Pitchfork Music Festival, the scoring system being on like a decimal point basis. Like these are the things that people talk about when they talk about Pitchfork is
100%.
Yeah, like what Pitchfork means as a critical arm. And I was the news portion of that, which means I was writing about, you know, album announcements and tour announcements, but also less fun things like, you know, people getting sued, allegations, like serious things. Yeah.
Basically sex, drugs, rock and roll. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Somebody overdoses, or, well, God forbid, but like, I mean, there's always drama in music, right? So I mean, somebody has to cover that shit, right?
100%. And then like the trick is figuring out like, well, what is the line and like where do you cover it? And where I often try to figure out is like, okay, will this affect this person's career? Like, yeah. If Drake gets sued by his stylist, it won't affect his music career. So it's like,
I like that you pulled in the Canadian example there.
Honestly, it wasn't even intentional. That like, you guys just
Like, he is Canadian still. I'm guessing by now he probably has dual citizenship because he was dating Rihanna, who lived in the States.
Maybe.
I barely think of him as Canadian anymore because he's so omnipresent in the States, but who the hell knows?
Yes.
And I'm not even like that diehard of a Drake fan personally. I'm bigger into Cadence Weapon, who's a friend of mine and just launched an album recently, PS. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, shout out Cadence Weapon, yeah.
Yeah, he's the shit. So interesting. So basically we might say that Pitchfork for the last decade or so has been the go-to source for reliable music journalism for millennials and Gen Z increasingly too, and maybe even some Gen Xers. Like it's been a very big influential voice.
Digitally. Yeah.
For those of us who follow music. So what the hell happened? Tell me what happened. Where did it come?
We had a day in November or December, I can't remember off the top of my head, where so Pitchfork, I was very lucky to be part of Pitchfork Union. So a lot of us, of the editorial staff unionized a few years back, got a union contract. The union contract changed my life in terms of not only
you started your own union or did you have like a person that, I don't know how that works, but.
So we unionized, Pitchfork unionized with the New York News Guild, and were among the first Condé Nast unions alongside New Yorker Union. Ars Technica had a union and Wired had a union. Cool. And so at the same time as the New Yorker won our contract.
Wow.
You know, it was a big deal. And this was a few years ago and like maybe 3 years ago that we got our contract or four. I can't remember. I think this year they're going to bargain for a new contract, the people who are still there and in the union. But yeah, really the main things with that was it's like it created this sense of like I work remotely. So everybody else is in New York City. For me, it was this big thing. Well, most everybody else, not everybody, but the majority of the staff works in New York. And for me, having the union really created a greater sense of community. And like, I feel like I had a better sense of like dialogue.
Solidarity, right?
And solidarity, for sure.
Isn't that the whole point? Like unions are generally a good thing, right?
but it really increased my quality of life, like on that front, as well as financially. Wow. It was great. But around November or December, there was a day where a bunch of us were like, hey, we're hearing that a lot of people at Wired are getting laid off. And there had been a lot of layoffs at Condé Nast. And we were nervous. And then we get pulled into this meeting where they're like, hey, meeting at 2. And we were like, hey, are we all getting laid off? And they were like, you'll find out in the meeting. And then in the meeting, they they said, we've saved your jobs.
They just said, you'll find out in the meeting? Like, thanks for the fucking... Sorry,
that was my feeling too.
I'm so sick of this, like, complete just treating human beings like robots. Like, no, you don't really matter to us, so just whatever, just hang on and you'll find out. Like, sorry, I just, that makes me really mad.
Well, I thought that was like the worst version of it, where it's like, oh, like they pulled us into a meeting, they said in November, hey, your jobs are safe, don't worry, we figured out the budget. Blah blah blah, and we were all mad because it was like, why couldn't you have told us this morning? Why did this?
And
have
why
to
would you? Why like? Kind of thanks thing. For traumatizing and stressing us right before Christmas, right?
Right, 100, and we'd had the possibility of layoffs hanging over us for like 2 months or something like that, because Roger Lynch, the CEO, had sent an email that was like, there will be layoffs or whatever.
Oh my god.
And
sorry.
So it like
that makes me like physically sick. Like because it's happened to me before, and it's. Anyway, it's traumatizing and it's infuriating. Awful. It's like, it's we're the ones doing the work, for Christ's sakes. Like, thanks for valuing anything that we do at all. Like, anyway, sorry.
No, it's truly, it's awful. So, like, if any of the people out there listening read the year-end lists that Pitchfork did, like, last year, those were all made under duress of, like, under the stress of, like, are we going to get laid off in the middle of working on these? Are they going to wait until we're done with the lists so they can then lay us off? Like, we were
Evan.
We were all really freaked out about it. And then we were told that we were safe. And then in January, there was... here was the timeline for me personally. I work nights, so during the night shift, I'd been waiting like 2 weeks for the Coachella lineup to drop, because this was my life once, was like my calendar year, like, surrounded a few specific moments, and like one of them is like, okay, when the Coachella lineup drops, that will be a big night, like, no matter how it works. So like me and Matthew Strauss, the other head of the news, were like, basically like trading off, like we were basically playing hot potato with the bomb, like where it was like, okay, I'm logging off for the night, still no Coachella lineup, and then I logged on and then the Coachella lineup dropped, so then I had to take care of it by myself because we were short staffed. So I post the Coachella lineup, you know, it does huge traffic, it becomes very quickly
it's Coachella, man, it's Coachella.
It's like in that moment it's like the big news story, it's like the top news story of all of Condé Nast in that like day. And then the next morning I get a text from Matthew Strauss, again the other head of the news, his title is the deputy managing editor, and he and I ran news together for years, and he's a friend of mine, and he texted me and said, hey, we are being pulled into a meeting with Anna Wintour,
what,
you should go, and it starts in 30 minutes, and I'm what? Like, and I'm like, what? With my, I'm like, it's like during the day I'm not at work.
What?
With, yeah, this is what happened.
Like, are we literally The Devil Wears Prada woman is legitimately just randomly calling me into a meeting. Like, what the?
Right.
Sorry. No, I just like can't. If that had happened to me, I'd be like, you're joking, right? Like, this is a joke.
But listen, like, this is as much as it's a parody, it is a real thing that happened. It's like,
oh my God.
So we get pulled into this meeting. We are told that there will be reductions and that Pitchfork's management structure is being folded under GQ, and that we
whatever
were,
the hell that means,
yeah, right. And then, and that, like, we
which
were
is not even a music, respectfully, like, GQ is cool, but like, it's a fashion men's thing. Like, I don't even think they cover music, do they? Like, I wouldn't know, but
GQ
anyway,
does, GQ has like does the thing that every major publication does, which is that they interview celebrities, and some celebrities happen to be musicians, so it's like that's kind of where their God. Music coverage always kind of felt to me as a Pitchfork
so
employee.
superficial I would
right.
call
it's
it
like...
respectfully, no one at GQ, please, Anna Wintour, don't sue me, but I mean, okay, got it, sorry, please continue.
I think you're fine, but like, but that's the thing, is like they have good writers and good journalists who write features where they interview, say, like they got the Andre 3000 interview and we didn't, like that kind of thing.
That'd be cool.
Sure, but like that, but that's sort of the thing of like, you know, they, so we were told, hey, if you get an email, you're, everybody's gonna get pulled into a meeting today. If you're pulled into a meeting with HR, that means you're gone. And if you get pulled into a meeting with GQ, that means that you know who you're reporting to next. And
wow.
So the union all got on an emergency chat. We all started comparing notes. And
good for
I
you.
Got the first meeting with HR of us in the union. And yeah, all told, they laid off me. They laid off 12 people total. And that's like, we don't have a big staff.
Yeah, but that's a whole fucking newsroom. Like, it's for people who are listening, they may not understand, like, you know, a lot of people who haven't worked in journalism and media probably don't realize that we work with teams.
Right.
Like today, for instance, like, my producer's off, so I'm on my own. People don't realize what it's like internally. So 12 people is a lot of people.
12 people is more than half the people. Like, when you break it down, like, if you look at a movie and you think about, like, a bustling newsroom or whatever, that one rarely exists anymore.
Yeah.
And two, it's like, if you think about what the Pitchfork bustling newsroom looked like, just, like, go in your mind palace and then just chop it in half and, like, see half of those desks empty. Like, that's proverbially what happened.
That makes me very angry. I'm sorry to hear that happen. That's deeply traumatic.
Yeah, and really, it's like the people that they laid off were the editor-in-chief, the managing editor, the news director, the features editor, both features editors, the senior staff writer, Mark Hogan, who covered all the investigative journalism of, like, the industry and of, you know, the big famous one that he did most recently was the Arcade Fire, Wynn Butler allegations, whatever you call him.
Oh, that was a big, big story here, obviously, because they're a Canadian band, right?
Yes, exactly. And, like, between him, Sam Sadomski is one of the greatest writers alive. He got laid off. Allison Hussey,
wow.
Linder, Matthew Ismail Ruiz, Marina Kozak, who did all the great art at Pitchfork, and Sean. And Maria Everett.
I loved that shit. You know, like, there's not a whole lot. People don't value that stuff anymore. They're like, oh, just use AI. It's like, I don't think people realize the value of you know, yeah. like really packaging a story in like a fantastic, memorable, palatable way. And like Pitchfork has been doing that for 10 years, longer than 10 years.
Yeah.
Until recently.
And Marina came in after they'd already dumped an entire art team and an entire video team. So it's like Pitchfork.
She
by
had
the
to
time
basically
that,
do everything probably.
With one person's help, yeah. But like that's the thing is like Pitchfork is, it was always lean and mean, and now it's like, you know, just a shadow, like a ghost of what it was with GQ running the shop, essentially. So that's kind of what happened, yeah.
Wow. Wow. I've just got this image in my head of Anna Wintour and her fucking sunglasses just, like, staring people down in, like, her nasty, evil way that she... that she famously does. Or I don't know if you've seen the show, Evan, Glamorous with Samantha Jones or Kim Cattrall, as we know her here in Canada. Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, she did like a digital only show, and it was essentially kind of like a version of The Devil Wears Prada, but spread out into like a series. It's fantastic. Highly recommend.
Very cool. Yeah, I probably
and
it,
anyway, and
anything
she
that has to do with Anna Wintour right now. For
no, of course not. But the point I was trying to make is it was like kind of a parody of The Devil Wears Prada, but if Anna Wintour was nice and like a normal person to some degree.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, really, like, no comment on how she behaved in the meeting. Like, I know that there are like reports out there that you can look up about how she was wearing sunglasses in the meeting. And honestly, like,
wow.
I don't remember is the honest answer. Like
it's deeply traumatizing. Anyone who's listening, I'm one of them who's ever been fired, especially over a Zoom call. Like you don't get over that.
Yeah, like, I was.
It
shocked.
Rocks your world. It is deeply traumatizing and demoralizing, and it should be illegal, frankly, because it's incredibly disrespectful to people. Like we're not cattle. We're not robots. We're human beings with lives and kids and whatnot, and it's just so shitty. Like anyway, sorry, I just
no please, thank you for it. No, I feel bolstered and buoyed by just like by being seen by you in this, so thank you.
It's not just me, it's everybody, right? Yeah. I'm a journalist too. I've covered music before too, and like it is first of all really depressing. Depressing landscape, but second of all, because we're all so traumatized and like barely hanging on, it's become like kind of a cannibalized field in that we're all competing for the same fucking shitty little bylines that pay what, like 20 cents a word or whatever. Like it used to be like a dollar a word, you know, you could live off of if you're writing like a good column for like a Maclean's magazine or Shadowlane. And now like those bylines are all just vanishing. And like, I'm speaking specifically in the Canadian context, but
let's talk about the broader context too, because you're not wrong. Like when I got laid off, I mean, really part of it was that I haven't freelanced for 12 years, right? Like not with any regularity, like I would do a piece here and a piece there, but like I had a full-time job where I could write about music. And frankly, I had
which is a dream job, no offense, but I mean, honestly, it's
my dream.
That's the dream. That's always been my dream. I've been since I was a little kid. It's like, it's a dream job. Anyway, sorry.
Oh no, it was 100% a dream job. But yeah, like I did it and now it's gone. And now it's like, okay, well, what's out there? And one, there's freelance work, but editorial freelance work does not pay the bills in any kind of substantial way. Like even if you get like, let's say like, for example, like you get a magazine piece that pays like really like, you know, $1,000 or something like that in an American currency. And then you've got, for me, like that's maybe a quarter of what I would make before, like not including like health insurance, like in a month, like or whatever. So it's like,
and you have a child, right? You have
I've got a
kid. Little kid. Yeah.
So
like, I mean,
really,
so realistically, you cannot live off that.
No, because it's like these are pieces that take time, that take energy, that take reporting. Like the ones that pay that well are rare, and they take a lot of time and energy to do it.
Yeah.
And you can't count on them to be there for you, 30 times in a year or whatever. Like,
yeah.
No, you're preaching
to the choir here, man. I've been trying to do it intermittently for my entire journalistic career. In fact, my first job in journalism, I didn't get paid for like 6 months or something. I was an intern. So
no, I mean, I will not name the publication, but shout out the job that I had, one of my first bylines in like any kind of online or like print magazine format. I literally did not get paid for them
ever. And did they advertise it as though you were going to get paid?
No, I knew what the rate was. I knew that I was, and I wasn't going to get paid much, but I literally didn't get paid anything. And
yeah, so that honest to God happens all the fucking time to all of us. To all of us. It happens to everybody. It happens to some of the best writers in the goddamn world. Like, it's stunning. And here's the worst thing. Pitch theft. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but you spend days researching and planning a story idea, you know, like reaching out to sources and like painting a picture in your head. You pitch it in a long email to an editor and they say no. And then they publish basically the exact same idea, but they get some random person on staff to do it in a far shittier way than you ever would have. That has happened to me. That's happened to me like dozens of times. Like, that should be illegal. But as a freelancer, we have no recourse. Like, we don't, right? Like, we don't have, like, what are we supposed to do? Like, sue them? Why would we sue them? Like, they didn't, you know?
So, well, like, who has the money to get into
or time piece? Or time, right? Like, who among us has a lawyer that we can retain other than through legal aid, right? So
and honestly, like, that's, I mean, like, you're speaking to a lot of issues with, you know, the editorial, like, just sort of really the kind of weird thing that's happening with journalism and arts journalism in particular, because that's the area where I know anything, is like, there's a miserliness to this industry that is just kind of like, okay, like, we want you to, like, I watched it happen at Pitchfork over a dozen years where it's like, you know, I was there before it got acquired by Condé Nast, and then it got acquired by Condé Nast, and I think everybody thought like, hey, we're all going to get paid and we're all going to have more of a budget, and like, now we've got this big system behind us.
Hooray, like, we can plan further ahead than like a month.
Right. And there was probably like some of that I didn't see, but honestly, like, from being at Condé, it was like, okay, now the video team's gone. Okay, now the art team is gone. Okay, this person quit and they didn't replace them, and that happened like 5 times. And it's like, there's a way where a cut corner after a while, it's just like, it's just death by a million cuts, right? It's one of those
things. That's exactly
Until that's
the perfect way to sum it up.
Right. But and then finally, like, they do something like what they did in January. And then what was difficult for me on a personal level was like, I got cut with just this cavalcade of heroes, right? Like, just these people who were like really impressive writers and editors who were at the top of their game. And I got cut with them, which in a way was like almost flattering, where it's like, you know what? Like, I didn't get fired all by myself.
Like the most millennial thing ever. It was almost flattering to have gotten fired among these great people. Like,
no, seriously. Like, I think I always
great, you know, among I, these great warriors.
I had it in the back of my head, like, I'm gonna get laid off one day, and when it happens, there's gonna be a line on a piece of paper, and they'll be like, "Well, this guy's getting paid more than we think he should get paid, and he'll be gone." So for it to happen to a dozen people and not just me, it made me feel like, okay, well, it's not personal. Like, it's not like it's just part of a very stupid decision that happened. Like, it's you know, like, that's the interesting thing, is it's like, there's no genuinely, like, we had this global like company meeting because, you know, Condé Nast has got its tendrils in every part of the map. So like, we're all sitting on this big like closed Zoom call where we can't comment or like say anything.
But wow, they muted all of you.
Well, they just didn't. It's like not a Zoom. It was just like on the like a company browser. So it wasn't
Oh my god.
There was no chat. Wow. There was no like comment section.
So it was just a one way conversation, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but like there was also like a room of like selected people to do like the Q&A, or like they gave the CEO some like pre selected questions or whatever.
Oh,
and honestly, like he admitted in this meeting, Roger Lynch, the CEO, who is also literally the Barbie villain, because he was literally on the Mattel board as his side hustle, which is like,
no,
his side hustle literally is like the thing from the Barbie movie. And also,
do you know that that explains maybe why the fuck the Barbie movie took off when it did, because that was supposed to be like the writer strike was ongoing then, and I remember thinking like, why am I hearing so much about this stupid Barbie movie when like all the best writers and actors in Hollywood are striking? Like, what is going on? And respectfully to anyone involved in that film, which I watched and will watch again and thought was hilarious and great, but Mattel, hello, Barbie.
yeah. So Roger literally said like, you know, we're doing record numbers on short form videos on, you know, like, you know, Reels, TikTok, Shorts on YouTube, things like that. And he was like, but, you know, we can't manage it. We don't know how to monetize it. So we had to lay off all of these people in video. And it's just like,
please feel so sorry for me for having to fire you guys. You don't understand. It's so hard for me. It's so hard for me to ruin your lives. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's
right.
But that's the thing, is like it feels like you're watching these people just kind of say, hey, like, I don't value your labor. And
yeah, well, that's what it boils down to. How the hell else are you supposed to interpret it? Like, the last time I wasn't let go, but I learned that my contract was ending for absolutely no reason whatsoever, even after I was told dozens of times, in fact, even in my interview, that it was going to be like at least a 1 year long contract. The woman doing it was crying. And I'm sitting there like, you're crying? Like, who's losing their job here, pal? Like, are you? Anyway, it's just astonishing to me how these people, like, all mostly boomers, let's be honest, behave and like just don't see us as people who need to like support ourselves.
Yeah, it's tough, but it's also just, it's just surprising that there's a short-sightedness in how you run the business. And it's a lot, I find that a lot of the time you see cuts being made in journalism, and the cuts are being made from people on the top who keep their jobs because mm-hmm. they can't figure out how to monetize the record-breaking numbers that you're producing, which for me was the case. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I definitely
key performance indicators.
Yeah, like I definitely produced the number one Pitchfork story of all time, you know, like
which one was that?
Well, it was Jazz Monroe's byline. I'm the one who caught it when it happened. I happened to be eating a bagel and got an alert on my phone, and it was Daft Punk's breakup, right? It's like,
oh wow.
So
wow.
Daft Punk
that's
broke
a pretty
up.
Fucking big story. That's a big story.
And it was like, okay, like, hey guys, hurry and do Daft Punk break up as a story. And then they did, and it was the biggest story ever. And that didn't matter, right? It's like none of these kinds of things.
Hey, no, but I mean, it matters to you and me, and it matters to our generation, and it matters to the people who loved past tense Pitchfork in its former form, respectfully to those who are respectfully to the people who are still there, like straight up. I've read Pitchfork my whole adult life.
And I'll just say, like, I don't have hard feelings to the people who are there. I'm just not part of it anymore.
No, of course not.
Yeah,
course
I just want to, I just want to make it clear to the listeners, like, I don't hold a grudge. I'm not like, I, you know, the people who are still there are doing what they got to do. I'm just like, they're not going to get my labor anymore, and that's
sure. Of course not. No, and this is the point: is like amongst our generation. I don't know if I'm making the point as clearly as I should, but we're all like competing for the same stuff. Like we're all struggling so hard to get by.
Right.
Millennials. Like I assume you're in your 30s, roughly, or
yes, yeah,
or,
36.
Like okay, me too. Same age, 88.
There we
represent.
Go.
But we're all like in this same shitty late stage capitalism quagmire where we don't like hate each other or anything, but we're so desperately trying to scrape by that we end up competing with each other for everything.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a choice, right? And it's frustrating. It makes it really hard to like well, not want to kill yourself, frankly. and it just makes it really hard to like be supportive of your colleagues and friends and stuff. You know what I mean? And like,
yeah,
because you're afraid you'll lose something or lose a byline or anyway. It's just so stupid.
No, but it's real because it's like you, a lot of the time you have to like just like sit on your words and just make sure that you're not like, you know, letting yourself become emotional about work. And it's like, you know, a lot of what I had to try to do at Pitchfork is figure out how to not let the job become my life, because
of course it
really could have. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, especially in the news, when you're a breaking news person who works nights and weekends, you are pulled to answer questions during the day. You are getting pings all the time from God, fucking Kanye or whoever. Like, just
point being, like, a lot of people don't understand this who aren't in journalism, which is kind of why I don't hang out with a lot of journalists, because I find it like cathartic to be able to like remove myself from the stress. But any journalist can tell you, we don't do it for the money. We do it because it's our calling and we fucking love doing it. Right? Like, you know.
And if I can use this opportunity to like plug my thing that I'm doing now as my
hustle,
which is not a hustle. I'm literally not making any real money from it. Like, it's, you know, not lucrative at all. It's literally just what I want to do and I'm having fun doing it. And I have I used to do a punk column at Pitchfork for years and years, and I stopped doing it, frankly, because it just wasn't the thing that paid the bills at Pitchfork. And I didn't really get like a lot of support to like work on it, so it just kind of fizzled out. But I sort of spiritually brought it back in a newsletter, and
how can we find it? Where can we read or listen to it? Whereabouts is it?
Yeah, so if you find me on social media, you'll find it pretty quick. My social media handle is just my first and last name, at Evan Minsker on Twitter, on Instagram, and then the newsletter is called Seesaw. It's named after one of my favorite songs, and it's c-saw.fun. So
sick, love it.
Yeah.
If anyone didn't catch that, I'll add that into the show notes of this episode, like a direct link, so people can click it and hit it up and subscribe and stuff. But anyway, I don't want to keep you much longer, Evan, because we've already maxed out our time here, but. Sincerely, like from the bottom of my heart, thank you for sharing your like trauma.
Honestly, like, just shout out everybody who's making things, because it's like
straight up,
it's honestly like, I know people who got laid off from Pitchfork, from LA Weekly, from LA Times, and like from all these different places who are all just trying to make something happen. I know people who got laid off from Law 360 this year.
There's like a lot of really good human beings. Like, we're not bad people, for the record, folks. Just because somebody gets laid off or fired doesn't mean they're not fantastic at their job.
It in fact means that they're probably very good at their job. But that's the thing, is like, people are making something, they're building their own things, they're pivoting. Like, this, keep an eye out. Just keep an eye out for what's coming from different people.
And I think I hear your screaming child in the background. Yeah, so I'm inclined to let you go.
Yes.
and be a parent now. So thank you so much, Evan Minsker, for sharing. Former Pitchfork guy. All the best to you and yours, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jen. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Bye.